From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and soundbites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Washington Watch with Tony Perkins starts now.
Just as using morphine to manage pain differs from using it to assist suicide, using hormones and puberty blockers to address a physical condition is far different from using it to address psychological distress associated with one's body. The Equal Protection Clause does not require the states to blind themselves to medical reality or to treat unlike things the same. And it does not constitutionalize one side's view of a disputed medical question.
That was the voice of the Tennessee Solicitor General Matthew Rice defending a Tennessee law that protects minors from experimental drugs and surgeries related to gender dysphoria before the United States Supreme Court this morning. Welcome to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Here's what's coming up on today's program. So a majority of the Supreme Court appear to be reluctant to strike down the Tennessee law based upon their questions and comments. We're going to speak with the Alabama Attorney General, Steve Marshall, who has been leading a multi-state coalition in opposition to the Biden administration's push to transgender our children. Outside the courtroom, voices were raised in defense of these protections for children.
The solution to the distress of our children is not lying to them. It's not taking away parts of their bodies or unstable parts of their development. It doesn't take a degree in biology to understand that a drug cocktail and a scalpel do not make a child the opposite sex.
That was Chloe Cole, a detransitioner and a powerful advocate, warning the public about the dangers of radical transgender ideology. FRC's Dr. Jennifer Bowens was at the court, and she'll join us with her insights later here on Washington Watch. And turning to international news in South Korea.
We welcome President Yoon's statement withdrawing the martial law order, and there was a unanimous vote in the National Assembly to reject the decision, and he followed up on that. In our judgment, any political disagreements need to be resolved peacefully and in accordance with the rule of law.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken commenting on the escalating political crisis in South Korea. After President Yoon withdrew the martial law order, the opposition party announced plans to impeach him. We'll get the expert analysis from Asian specialist Gordon Chang later on Washington Watch. In Europe, French lawmakers have made history by ousting the Prime Minister, Michel Barnier, in a no-confidence vote. Now, this is the first time in 60 years that a government has been toppled in this way. What does this mean for Europe's political future? We'll discuss it with Peter McIlvenna, who's the co-founder of Hearts of Oak in the UK. And closer to home, the final U.S. Congress House race was called yesterday, nearly a month after the November election. So what does this mean for the 119th Congress? Well, FRC Action's Matt Carpenter will provide us with an update. And finally, a big thank you to everyone who partnered with us on Giving Tuesday. We are deeply grateful for your generous support in helping us stand for faith, family, and freedom here at the Family Research Council and on Washington Watch. And by the way, I want to invite you to join FRC in our study of God's Word in 2025 with the second volume of the Stand on the Word Journal. Now, this new spiral-bound journal accompanies our chronological Stand on the Word Bible reading plan and covers Isaiah through Revelation. This resource will help you as you grow in your understanding of God's Word. And it also makes a great gift for loved ones this Christmas season. To order your copy, go to TonyPerkins.com or simply text the word journal to 67742. That's journal to 67742. Well, as I mentioned this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on whether or not Tennessee's Senate Bill 1 violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution's 14th Amendment. The law, which protects minors from so-called gender transition procedures, is similar to those passed in nearly half the states in the nation. And by most accounts, the Supreme Court's conservative justices appear likely to side with the state of Tennessee. Joining me now to discuss this is the Attorney General of Alabama, Steve Marshall, who is among those leading the charge against the Biden administration's push for irreversible mutilation of children. He filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court case and was at the court today in support of Tennessee's law. General Marshall, welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here, Tony. It seems like we continue to talk about this issue, but it gets better every time.
Well, finally, it appears that the tide is turning as the facts are coming out. But I want to first get your thoughts, your general thoughts on how the arguments went today and where the justices may be leaning.
Yeah, I think the Solicitor General for Tennessee did an outstanding job in being able to truly eviscerate the argument that was being made by both the Department of Justice and the ACLU that this was somehow or another a law passed by the state of Tennessee that dealt with gender and that discriminated based upon one sex. And that's not at all what Tennessee has done. What they've done is to be able to outlaw a procedure that creates experimental treatment on kids with tremendously adverse effects. And so I was very pleased by the questioning that we saw from the court, particularly the aggressive pushback from Justice Alito when the Department of Justice truly misstated the facts as it relates to how accepted this type of treatment is and what the potential consequences are for kids long term. And so I feel confident that Tennessee will prevail and gives an opportunity not only for Tennessee to be able to continue this protection, but also the countless other states across the country that likewise want to be able to protect our kids.
So speaking of that, General Marshall, will this case have implications for these other states? I mean, I think in total we have 26 states that have similar laws.
I think it will, only as it relates to the legal standard that will be used to evaluate the particular state statutes. For example, when the court rules in this case, we'll have an opportunity to be able to present what the court has done to our district judge to be able to establish why Alabama clearly has a rational basis to be able to protect our children and to use that from the court's perspective to determine whether or not the statute itself is lawful. But Tony, I would say that even if the court were to rule with the plaintiffs and to say that there's a higher level of scrutiny that needs to occur, I believe the medical evidence is so strong that states are going to be able to meet that standard as well.
Did that come forth in today's hearing?
You know, sadly not, only because, you know, the Tennessee case is relatively new from a litigation side, whereas Alabama's, we have a much more robust development of the underlying facts. And you and I have discussed previously about the absolute fraud that's taken place on parents and children across the country as we see this coalition of social justice lawyers, the Biden administration through Admiral Levine, influencing medical professionals and developing standards of care, not for what's best for kids, but instead to advance their own political agenda. And clearly that's not right. I don't think anybody can accept this idea that medical practice ought to be dictated by your political philosophy and not what's in the best interest of children. And so very comfortable that we're going to be able to develop that for all of the states to be able to use. I think when judges have an opportunity to hear it, as recently they did in the state of Missouri, that we're going to find compelling orders supporting this idea of protecting our children.
It would appear, General Marshall, that as the facts have been coming out, in not just in the courtrooms, but in dialogues like this one, and as you've had to defend the law there in Alabama, and as legislators have taken up this issue, taken testimony, and what we see internationally, as many foreign countries are backing away from these radical positions, it appears that the public opinion on this has shifted quite significantly in the last 5 years.
No, I think absolutely. And when Alabama first passed its law, it was only one of three states to have done so. And candidly, it was with great opposition from many that felt like that we were not doing what we needed to do to be able to help kids deal with gender dysphoria or gender incongruence. But yet what we've learned, and particularly with the development in Europe, and who would have thought that we'd be looking to Europe to be able to support these ideas? But when they engage in that systemic review of the literature, they found little to no evidence that these treatments, in fact, help kids and solve significant risk, both short-term and long-term, when kids undergo puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and more particularly surgeries. And all we've seen over these last 5 years is a continued push from the literature and others that have had a chance to view this in an unbiased way, is to say this is not the direction that we need to be teaching kids or at least treating kids that suffer from these conditions.
General Marshall, you have tracked the court for some time, and the court has a propensity to surprise in its opinions that it releases. So while the questioning and the comments may be leading toward a support of the Tennessee law in this case, what are some of the possible outcomes? Because sometimes they can sidestep some of the issues. What might be some of the possible outcomes when the court rules on this, probably near the end of June of this next summer?
Well, one thing that Justice Alito did, I think, a fabulous job today was to really push back on the remedy that was being sought by the petitioners in this case, so that they very much narrowed the scope of what they were asking. So to the extent that you were looking for worst-case scenarios, it would be that this court would come down and accept this idea that there is a heightened level of scrutiny that needs to be placed on laws of this type. They wouldn't be deciding whether or not Tennessee's law was in fact valid or invalid, but instead would just simply say that we will embrace this idea that this is a gender-specific law for which the state has to meet a higher burden of proof. But as we were able to establish in our 11th Circuit in a concurring opinion issued by Judge Brasher, he believes that even if it's a heightened level of scrutiny, the evidence is so compelling, the facts are so strong, and that we would be able to meet that burden as well. And so I remain confident, regardless of the result of this decision, that states will be in a good position. But I truly believe that we'll have a 6-3 or 5-4 decision supporting the efforts of Tennessee and validating the ruling they received from the Sixth Circuit.
In your opinion, did the opponents of this law, did they establish anything in today's oral arguments?
I don't think they did. In fact, their greatest advocates were coming from the bench, whether it be Justice Sotomayor or Justice Jackson. They advanced more of the argument than we heard from either of the two advocates. But that shouldn't surprise us, correct? I mean, those are individuals that we did not expect necessarily to be in favor of the Tennessee law. In fact, they dissented when the court had on its shadow docket a question involving Idaho for reasons very similar to they expressed today. But I think that the law itself, as Tennessee was able to present today, is very compelling for the court to be able to use the rational basis review. And I think that's the conclusion the court's going to ultimately reach.
If I read this correctly, one of the attorneys that was opposing the law for the ACLU was a transgender attorney, setting kind of a historical record, being the first transgender to argue before the Supreme Court. Is this more of the identity politics that they were hoping to use to bolster their case?
Well, I think absolutely, Tony. And this is an advocate that went on a TV interview the day before his argument and said that a 2-year-old can make a decision about whether or not to change their gender. Obviously, that's not what Americans believe. It shows that this is more political than it is legal. And we need to do right by our kids to make sure that those who are suffering from gender dysphoria have the right type of treatment, but we don't want them to be experiments that harm them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, this is something that we will look back on, I think, in years from now. Hopefully we'll look back knowing we got it right. General Marshall, always great to see you. Thanks so much for stopping in today and joining us.
Thank you.
And folks, this is an issue we need to continue to pray about. Because these are individuals, these young people, they have some really significant issues that they need to be able to work through, but work through correctly. So after the break, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jennifer Bowens about this a little bit more. So don't go away.
The throne of Jesus Christ is unchallenged. His name was never on the ballot to begin with, and it's never going to be on the ballot. He's the King of Kings, and he's the Lord of Lords, and nothing's going to change that. And so our mission stays the same. Preach the gospel, make disciples, get ready for heaven. In the meantime, that we're to advance the concerns of the kingdom of God here on earth.
America has entered a critical and vulnerable period from now until January the 20th. Join Family Research Council for Operation Prayer Shield, a 10-week prayer initiative for our nation. From now until January 20th, our country faces global challenges, a transition of leadership, and a lame duck session of Congress. This season calls for heightened spiritual vigilance, discernment, and prayer. Text the word SHIELD to 67742 to join us. You'll have access to prayer points, scripture, prayer calls. Text SHIELD to 67742. Unite with us and pray for our nation.
Let's not be discouraged. Don't lose heart. Don't lose the faith. Stand now strong, because the Lord has given us the great privilege of living in a time when our choices matter, when our lives matter, when our courage matters. So let's stand together and save this great country. God bless the United States of America.
The American Republic has a freedom like no other. It has roots in the scriptures far more than any other heritage. And if we, as followers of Jesus and conservatives, don't defend it, who will?
Neutrality is not an option. There are many Christians who believe that if we just keep our heads down, if we just don't say the wrong thing, that somehow we will come out of this unscathed. You're naive if you think that. Because what they want from us is not our silence. What they want from us is our submission.
Part of the dilemma of Christianity in our generation is that we've relied a little too much on human wisdom and human reasoning, human strength, human resource, and we've relied too little on the power of God and God's ability to open doors that we can't open and do things that we couldn't even hope to begin to do.
This may not be an easy task, but we are living in a moment of challenge, but also of great opportunity. And we know always that we are not alone, that His Spirit empowers us and protects us, and that He can do the unimaginable. Dobbs, after all, was never supposed to happen.
Father, we thank You. You have entrusted us with this moment in history, and I pray that we would be found faithful, and that as a result of our faithfulness to You, that thousands, millions would come into the kingdom as they would experience the forgiveness of sin and the new life that is found only in Jesus Christ. Amen. Welcome back to this Wednesday edition of Washington Watch. Good to have you with us. And by the way, let me remind you once again, you can get a copy of the Stand on the Word Journal, part two. Comes out. It's out. It's ready. It starts in January, so you can order your copy. If you're on this journey, you'll need the second part. So text journal to 67742. That's journal to 67742. In the last segment, I was discussing with Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall the legal arguments in the case that was before the U.S. Supreme Court regarding Tennessee's law that protects minors from so-called gender transition procedures, which are both experimental and they're surgical and they're irreversible. And now I want to turn a little bit to the scientific aspects of this issue, as well as the emotional issues, the psychological issues. So joining me now to discuss this, Dr. Jennifer Bowens, director of the Center for Family Studies here at the Family Research Council. Dr. Bowens has worked extensively as a researcher and a clinician providing trauma-focused treatment to children in foster care and behavioral health settings, and also to adults who've experienced interpersonal traumas. Dr. Bowens, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Tony.
Now, you spoke at the rally there on the steps of the Supreme Court in support of Tennessee's law. Earlier today, give us a sense of what the environment was like there.
It was a wild scene, Tony. it's always interesting when the only arguments people have are to get very angry and emotional. And of course, we had emotion on our side, too. This issue is very it's a lightning rod for sure. But, we had people coming over from the other side with bullhorns while we're talking. Yeah. and blaring them. So,
That's not exactly typical.
The most civil.
That's right? Typical. I've been there many times, and they try to shout you down because they really can't defend the position that they're holding. Therefore, they want to silence the opposition. And that's really what we're seeing in this cancel culture. But inside the courtroom, the facts were talked about. Now, we were talking about with Attorney General Steve Marshall, that it was focused more on the legal, not so much the scientific. They didn't get into that. That obviously is disappointing because that's one of the areas that you focused on.
Yeah, And, you know, some of the things that should be brought out, which I've mentioned in testimonies before, which is we don't have any research that shows, you know, who, let's just for a minute play that this is a real idea. You know, we don't have any research that says who's going to, you know, enjoy gender affirming care over time. You know, if there's such thing as non-binary and fluid gender, then who's going to stay the opposite sex for how long? And so then you've removed their body parts, and then they've decided a year from now that they're actually, you know, swashing back to a different gender. And, you know, ideally in the scientific world, you'd have instruments that you would develop that would predict those types of things. But we're just going in like the Wild West, just performing all kinds of crazy experiments on children without any sense of real grounding in the scientific method. And that's why I said in my speech today, these procedures should have never been performed on a single child.
You know, I think in years from now, we'll look back on this as we have on other things that have been done in this country where, you know, people have been sterilized and other actions have been taken. Even you look to what the Nazis did in their medical experimentation that they did on human beings. Now, I know they did, I don't want to do total comparison, but the fact is we look back on that and we're shocked that we allowed that to happen. And I think this is one of those moments. But that said, Dr. Bowens, I these things are real, the emotions that these individuals, the gender dysphoria, but what's been missing, and you and I have talked about this before, is to go to the source of the issue that's driving the dysphoria, the fact they're uncomfortable, they don't feel like they're in the right sex. Usually this is attached to some form of trauma.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of the think tanks on the other side who are in support of this issue, their own research has shown that a number of people who are trans identified have big, huge trauma histories. I mean, we're talking a significant portion of people. And those are just the ones who know enough to claim that. So we're not even talking about the people who don't even have a sense of what trauma is, which you might think that seems illogical, but it's true. Doing trauma work, a lot of times people are so accustomed to living a certain way and experiencing horrific things that they don't identify that
so
as
when we
as
say
wrong.
Trauma, give us some, our viewers and listeners, some sense of the type of trauma we're talking about.
Well, sexual abuse, physical abuse, some forms of emotional abuse, you know, when someone is calling you names and degrading your personhood, or withholding basic care from your life, especially as a child. These are forms of abuse that many of the trans-identified people have gone through. And again, maybe it's not to that level, but usually you can, you know, if you work with someone, you can find a source of where this idea came from. And that's what's not happening in the right. mental health profession.
It can become kind of a defense mechanism as well to keep this trauma from occurring again. So as we debate this public policy, and we're firmly, you know, we stand on the truth, man and woman, God created male and female, but we need to approach it with compassion and understanding that these are people that are often hurting and they need help. It's just not through a scalpel or through drugs, experimental drugs. It's something else that they're in search of and they need help with.
Yeah. And we're actually, our society has been making it worse for these folks because now they have trauma upon trauma to deal with. The very people that they went to for help are inflicting more trauma through the very, you know, supposed answer that they've are giving them. And so we're going to have a lot of people who've been affected by this, not only that have to deal with the root cause, but now they have to deal with, you know, dealing with forgiving a whole profession that has led them astray. Right. It's a blind leading the blind.
Yeah. And it is something that we absolutely need to be praying about and praying for these individuals. It's real for them, and we need to help them find a way out that is right and will lead to a fulfilling life for them. Dr. Balance, always great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us. All right, folks, don't go away. It begins here and here and here. Every day. Before you stand, you need solid ground. Standing in a culture that wants you to surrender the truth won't work unless you have a firm foundation. At Family Research Council, we have that firm foundation, and you can find us standing. We stand for the value of all human life. We stand for the right of families to flourish. And every day, we stand for your freedom to believe and to live out those beliefs, both at home and abroad. We work with government officials, educating them on the issues from a biblical worldview. And when necessary, we hold them accountable. We equip Christians across America to be informed and to take action in their communities. With our daily radio program, television appearances, and vast online presence, we reach people where they are. We envision an America where all human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. And that won't be realized if we're not standing. Stand for faith. Stand for family. Stand for freedom. Stand with us at FRC.
Did you know there are many faithful Christians on Capitol Hill fighting alongside Family Research Council for faith, family, and freedom? Download the Stand Firm app today to view the latest video series from FRC, Defending the Faith, Profiles in Leadership. The series features exclusive sit-down interviews with our nation's leaders that go beyond the policies and politics to the events that brought them to Washington, D.C. Download the Stand Firm app today.
All right, welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us. And I do want to encourage you to pray into these situations. That's what's different about Washington Watch. We're not only giving you the news, but from a biblical perspective and giving you something to pray about. And we need to pray for these young people that have been led down this path of confusion. And there's a lot of contributing factors, but we know what the source of help is for them. We need to pray for them. And in fact, Operation Prayer Shield, as we're praying for our country right now in this interim period between administrations, this was our prayer point for today. And you can join us in Operation Prayer Shield. Simply text SHIELD, that's S-H-I-E-L-D, to 67742 and join us in praying for our nation and our allies as well. And here's something else to pray about. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is facing an impeachment vote later this week following his declaration of martial law yesterday. He was forced to lift it 6 hours later when the National Assembly voted unanimously to overturn it. Now, the last time martial law was imposed in South Korea was in 1980, 7 years before the country transitioned from a military dictatorship to a democracy. Now, considering how South Korea has been hailed as a success story in democracy building, and also, you know, you look back, the church has grown significantly in South Korea, Christianity. What's happening over there? Where did these events come from? And what does this tell us about the future? Join me now to discuss this is Asian affairs expert Gordon Chang. He's a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute and author of several books, including his latest, Plan Red, China's Project to Destroy America. You can follow him on X under the handle at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much, Tony.
All right, so where did this come from? Give us a little background on what's been taking place there in South Korea. This was a conservative president. What's happening?
Well, Yoon Suk-yeol was extremely unpopular for his domestic affairs. And clearly there have been so many issues, including, for instance, one that has attracted a lot of attention, his wife getting photographed accepting a very expensive couture handbag. But it was just one disaster after another. Now, this is the same Yoon Suk-yeol who has been a hero of freedom in North Asia. He very bravely, to his great detriment in terms of popularity in South Korea, but this was a profile and courage moment. He started coordinating with Japan at the insistence of the United States. Now, previous South Korean presidents had refused to do that because they realized how unpopular it was, but Yoon put himself on the line. And that helped to build a coalition to contain a very aggressive North Korea and a very aggressive China. But Yoon decided that he was going to do something which was unimaginable, which is declare martial law. He did it incompetently. He rescinded it, as you pointed out, after 6 hours. And he is going to have to resign. If he's not going to resign, he's probably going to be impeached on Friday or Saturday. And that will cause a crisis in South Korea.
What might that mean for the United States as we have a transition of administrations here, Donald Trump coming in, a conservative? What does the future look like there?
It doesn't look good, Tony. And the reason is that the conservative forces have always been very pro-America. The progressive or the leftist camp has been very anti-America. And for instance, Yoon's immediate predecessor, Moon Jae-in of the Democratic Party of Korea, a leftist, was essentially governing like a North Korean. And he did all as possible to undermine the alliance with the United States. So, for instance, when President Trump visited Seoul during his first term, Moon did all he could to disrespect not only President Trump, but the United States of America. This could go back to a very difficult time because this will embolden the North Koreans and the Chinese. And we know that with a weakened president or prime minister who will become president, then you have a point where the North Koreans may think they can use their leverage in South Korean society through the unions to try to change the form of governance in South Korea.
Now, Yoon had said that he was taking these actions of martial law in part because of the influence of North Korean communists. Is there evidence that there has been infiltration?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's clear. And everyone knows it. The Democratic Party of Korea is heavily infiltrated by North Koreans. And as I mentioned, Moon Jae-in, the last leftist president, governed as if he were a North Korean asset. But that doesn't mean that that Yoon should have done what he did, which was to declare martial law, because that was going to be always extremely unpopular. You know, there had been talk about martial law in the months leading up to this, but nobody thought that it would actually occur because it was just inconceivable. Yoon made it conceivable, and he's going to pay the price for it.
We only got about 45 seconds left, Gordon, but the church has grown significantly and been a major factor in South Korea. What has happened there? Has something happened with the church-state relationship or the influence of the church?
The church is still very strong in Korea, and it was not only just South Korea. The church was strong in North Korea as well before the Kim regime, and there are still Christian communities in North Korea. In South Korea, the church is doing fine, and I think it will prosper. And this is a good story for Christianity in Asia.
All right. Gordon Chang, always great to talk with you. Always appreciate your insights on what's happening.
Thank you so much, Tony.
All right. Gordon G. Chang, if you want to keep up with him on X, he's the one I go to when I'm trying to figure out what's happening in Asia. But another prayer item, as he said, this could complicate the U.S. relationship with South Korea, emboldening that axis of evil that involves North Korea. The world is on fire. You see all the pieces falling into place as we read through Scripture. We need to be praying. All right, when we come back, we're going to give you an update. The latest congressional race has been called. Hello, I'm Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. Behind me is one of the most recognizable buildings in all the world, the U.S. Capitol. What does it stand for? Well, most people say government. But you know the Bible talks about four institutions of government? You know what they are? And do we have a republic or a democracy? Well, what do you say? Also, what about this thing, separation of church and state?
Does that mean Christians shouldn't be involved in government? Guess what? We address those issues and more in our new God and Government course. I invite you to join us to see what the historical record and the Bible has to say about government. Join us for God and Government.
Everything we do begins as an idea. Before there can be acts of courage, there must be the belief that some things are worth sacrificing for. Before there can be marriage, there is the idea that man should not be alone. Before there was freedom, there was the idea that individuals are created equal. It's true that all ideas have consequences, but we're less aware that all consequences are the fruit of ideas. Before there was murder, there was hate. Before there was a Holocaust, there was the belief by some people that other people are undesirable. Our beliefs determine our behavior, and our beliefs about life's biggest questions determine our worldview. Where did I come from? Who decides what is right and wrong? What happens when I die? Our answers to these questions explain why people see the world so differently. Debates about abortion are really disagreements about where life gets its value. Debates over sexuality and gender and marriage are really disagreements about whether the rules are made by us or for us. What we think of as political debates are often much more than that. They're disagreements about the purpose of our lives and the source of truth. As Christians, our goal must be to think biblically about everything. Our goal is to help you see beyond red and blue, left and right, to see the battle of ideas at the root of it all. Our goal is to equip Christians with a biblical worldview and help them advance and defend the faith in their families, communities, and the public square. Cultural renewal doesn't begin with campaigns and elections. It begins with individuals turning from lies to truth. But that won't happen if people can't recognize a lie and don't believe truth exists. We want to help you see the spiritual war behind the political war, the truth claims behind the press release, and the forest from the trees.
Welcome back to Washington Watch, the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, our word for today comes from Isaiah chapter 22. You looked in that day to the armor of the house of the forest. You also saw the damage to the city of David, that it was great, and you gathered together the waters of the lower pool. You numbered the houses of Jerusalem and the houses you broke down to fortify the wall. You also made a reservoir between the two walls for the water of the old pool. See, King Hezekiah took significant steps to protect Jerusalem from the Assyrian threat. Archaeologists have even uncovered some of the preparations mentioned by Isaiah, gathering water, fortifying walls, and building reservoirs. Yet Isaiah points out to the core problem. Quote, "You didn't not look to its maker, nor did you have respect for him who fashioned it long ago." You see, these preparations, though practical, lacked reliance on God. Action is important, but it must be grounded in faith and submission to God's will. Let us remember to act, but always begin by seeking Him. To find out more about our journey through the Bible, go to frc.org/Bible or text Bible to 67742. That's Bible to 67742. Before I go to my next guest, I want to provide a quick election update. Now, tomorrow will mark 1 month since Election Day, and believe it or not, there was still one race that remained uncalled until yesterday, the one for California's 13th Congressional District. Now, here with a quick update on where things stand is Matt Carpenter, Director of FRC Action. Matt, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, so it took a month, but we have finally gotten all of the results. Give us the results of California's 13th Congressional District.
Yeah, so Tony, election season is over. I don't know if a little extra turkey slowed down the vote there at the end in California, but we have the results for California's 13th Congressional District. As you pointed out, this is the last race from election night that we were tracking, trying to get results on. And Democrat Adam Gray prevailed over Republican incumbent John Duart in that race by, almost a breathtaking only 187 votes. Tony, you and I both have seen some close races over the years. I think this beats the record from last election when Lauren Boebert won by just over 200 votes. So races seem to be getting closer and closer nowadays.
Well, that's amazing. Less than 200 votes. I mean, that's the size of, that's smaller than the average church size, especially in California. They got these big churches. But a church, think about that for just a moment. One church, couple families, could actually make the difference in the outcome of one of these congressional races.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I know there's a lot of great folks on the ground in California who were working in churches, taking advantage of some of the ballot chasing laws there in California and getting the word out and educating voters. And it's just more evidence that all that work is needed. There's more of it that needs to be done as we look to the 2026 midterms already. It's election season. It never ends, Tony.
All right, Matt. So the last race is decided, California's 13th. What does that leave in terms of the balance in the U.S. House of Representatives now that these races have all been called?
So right now there's 220 Republicans for the 119th Congress to 215 Democrats. That's just a two-seat majority for Speaker Johnson. With a 435-member body, you need 218 for a majority. So any additional drop-offs at this point is going to be problematic. It's going to make the operations of the House that much more difficult. And as we already know, Matt Gaetz has resigned from Congress and will have a special election to fill his seat. We also know Lee Stefanik, a New York Republican, is going to go on to be potentially the U.N. ambassador under the Trump administration, and then obviously Michael Walls in Florida's 6th Congressional District was tapped for National Security Advisor in the Trump administration. We'll have some special elections in the spring. In Florida specifically, go ahead.
Where does that leave them then beginning in January if we have those three members that won't be there?
They'll be down to 218 members, Tony, and that's the exact number you need for a majority. So, I mean, you can't have a sick day. You can't have a member miss their flight. Things get really hairy at that point. So, we'll see how these special elections pan out. All three Republicans who will be leaving Congress are running in safe districts, or they ran, I should say, in safe districts. And you got to figure you'll probably have a Republican win those special elections, but you still have to run an election to see how that pans out. In Florida, we know January 28th is going to kick off a special primary here in Florida. And then April 1st, we'll have the results of those special elections in Florida. We have yet to get word on what's going to happen in New York, the timing there. But I think it's safe to say, it'll be a temporary 218-member conference for the House Republicans. And probably around May or June, I anticipate they'll get back up to 220, but we'll see.
Well, here's a prediction for you, Matt. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of money spent in those three special elections. I think you can count on that. Matt Carpenter, thanks so much for taking time to give us an update today.
Thanks, Tony.
Wow. I was actually talking with the House Speaker about that over the weekend, that he's going to have almost zero margins to work with when it comes to moving forward President-elect Trump's 100-day agenda. So another prayer item, folks, and we're going to have more on that as we get into the new Congress. All right, this weekend, speaking of President-elect Trump, he will be making his first, appearance on the global stage as President-elect by attending the reopening of the newly restored cathedral in the Notre Dame Cathedral in France, which was nearly destroyed in 2019 by a devastating fire. Now, Trump was invited by French President Emmanuel Macron to join him for this. And, of course, that country's in the middle of a political crisis that deepened earlier today with the ousting of the French prime minister. Now, is there something happening in Europe that we need to be watching? And if so, what are the implications for us, just as we were talking about what's happening in South Korea? Joining me now live from London to discuss this is Peter McIlvenna. He's the co-founder of Hearts of Oak, a freedom of speech alliance, and he works in the office of the UK's House of Lords. Peter, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you, Tony. Thank you so much.
And thank you for staying up late. I know it's late there in the UK. So let's start with the news that broke just a few hours ago today. Today, a historic no-confidence vote by the French Parliament. Tell us what's happening there.
Well, Tony, it's never too late to join you. But in France, we had the French Prime Minister, Michel Barnier, who is known to British viewers because he was the one that basically headed up the Brexit negotiations on behalf of the EU. Very influential figure. He was put in by Emmanuel Macron after Macron's big defeat, basically, in the last elections when Marine Le Pen came first, got the biggest share of the vote. And instead of Marine Le Pen forming the government as the largest grouping, the two smaller groupings on the left came together. And that has not lasted. Michel Barnier, obviously the prime minister appointed by the president, similar, I guess, in Russia, where Putin appoints the prime minister, similar in France. So the prime minister, the president, Macron, appointed Barnier, who he thought would be a pick that everyone would accept. Now, he forced through a budget bill yet 2 days ago, I think, without a vote of parliament, which is very strange. And that obviously upset not only Marine Le Pen's party, the largest party, but the far left party. So left and right came together and said, we're not having this. And they had a vote of no confidence. And Michel Barnier lost that by 330 to 280. So he will have to resign.
So, Peter, he's a conservative. This was what he was pushing through in terms of the budget, as I understand it, was to address the out-of-control spending there in France. And so what does this tell us about? Is there a political shift that's taking place there in Europe?
There is a big political shift, and this is what's exciting to the FRC viewers, to the American audience, that this is Europe becoming open to President Trump stepping back into the White House. This is why I'm really excited what's happened. We've seen changes in Austria, in the election in Austria. The German government have collapsed and they're going to have elections with Alternative for Deutschland polling at 20%. We've got Macron being very weak. And you've always had that Franco-German alliance in the EU. It's been Germany and France, the two big powers in Europe. Germany, very weak politically after Merkel left, and she basically has not been replaced. And in France, Macron's become weaker and weaker. And that means into that gap is the populist parties that have done hugely well across Europe, whether it's Viktor Orban in Hungary, whether it's Meloni in Italy, whether it's the Swedish Democrats doing exceptionally well up in Sweden, whether it's the Freedom Party polling extremely well in Austria, and on in Spain, the populist party came second, in Portugal it came third. So there's a resurgence of the nation state, putting the nation above the EU. And that's what really is puts fear into the heart of Europe, the establishment, because they want the European Union project to continue, in which it's telling those small states what they must do, and Germany and France telling them. But with that vacuum in Germany and France, with Marine Le Pen doing exceptionally well on the last election, I saw a poll and she's polling at 39% in an election that happened 2 days ago in France. So doing even better and better. And that means you've got a lot of parties actually in power or holding the reins of power because of coalitions who are very friendly and very open and very welcoming to President Trump. So I think instead of 2016, where there was a clash, now we could see an embrace. And I think that's an extremely positive thing.
Well, is that a part of Macron's invitation to Trump to come there to Notre Dame this weekend?
Macron will do whatever he has to do to survive. He is a survivor, and he's not a conviction politician. He will feel the public opinion, and he will go with it. I don't know what he really believes as a politician, similar to Keir Starmer in the UK, devoid of convictions. So it's curious. When I saw President Trump had been invited, I saw that, I think, or beginning of today, I was intrigued and pleasantly surprised. Maybe Biden can't take international trips any longer. Maybe he's not trusted outside the White House. I don't know. But obviously, Macron is trying to reach out, trying to position himself. And Macron and Keir Starmer in the UK, they've tried to position themselves as the new rulers, the new kings of Europe. But they're both very weak in terms of many areas. So I think this is Macron trying to save his skin, reach out to President Trump. But President Trump remembers and knows how some of the European leaders treated him in the past. And he has a long memory. So I think that he will be able to bypass Macron, really, and go to other governments and leaders that are much more positive and embracing of America, revitalizing itself and reaching out to the world and beginning to address some of the issues we face worldwide.
Peter, we just have a few minutes left, but I want to transition to a topic you and I have talked about as it pertains to the UK, but it applies to all of Europe, and that is the presence of Christianity and Orthodox religion as it pertains to the Christian faith. The president going there for the rededication or the unveiling of the revised, the rebuilt cathedral. That's a centerpiece. I mean, that's an iconic place there in France, but it no longer represents what it once did. Give us the state of play from a standpoint of the influence of Orthodox Christianity in Europe and what that means for the future.
Well, I was in Paris.
Oh, I think we lost it right when I was getting to the heart of what we wanted to talk about. Well, maybe we'll get him back. I don't know. Somewhere between here and the UK, we lost the signal.
Heck yeah.
There he is. All right. Go right ahead.
I don't know what happened across the water, but I was in Paris just 4 weeks ago outside the Notre Dame Cathedral, just obviously before it opened. And it's a glorious building, over 800 years old. And I was looking at some of the statistics. I mean, the spire was built of oak, burned down, obviously, in that fire 5.5 years ago. But it was 750 tons of oak lined with lead, and those oak trees were cut down in 1160. That shows the history and heritage. Now, that has changed. We have seen, I know in the UK in the last 5 years, we have seen 200 churches affected by arson. And about a year ago, in 2022, in European Parliament, an MEP talked about attacks on 613 churches across Europe. So we are seeing that is an attack on that. But then also we are seeing nations of collapsing Christianity. In the UK, we just had an assisted suicide bill, assisted dying bill passed, where you can help someone end their life. And that's been hotly debated for 30 years in the UK. And that is now getting pushed through. And a bishop yesterday was saying that the UK has lost its Christian ethos, its Christian basis, whenever it thinks actually the killing of those who are no longer beneficial to society is a positive thing. And we've seen that happen across Europe. In Belgium, you can now have children killing themselves if they're depressed. So we are seeing a change in what it means for life. And because churches are not there shining brightly, teaching school children what life is all about. We're all made in the image of God. When you take away that, then anything fills into that vacuum. And we are seeing a culture of death across Europe.
Is it very quickly, I got 30 seconds left, but Peter, as American politics influence Europe through Trump, could also we see the church of the United States impact Europe as well?
Oh, big time. I think many European churches are looking to the States, are looking at that confidence of actually what it means to have a Christian worldview, a Christian ethos. And when Trump goes back into the White House and speaks truth, then Europe will be watching. And I think we'll see churches excited, growing and embracing their heritage once again.
Wow. Well, we look forward to being a part of that conversation with you as that time comes. So thanks so much for joining us. And folks, thank you for joining us as well. We're out of time. Until next time, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.